Conflict of interest? What conflict of interest? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. There are more than 100 Trump companies operating in more than a dozen countries. We'll assess what conflicts of interest that might pose for Donald Trump when he becomes president. We'll also hear from union workers in Indiana. Candidate Trump promised 100% that their factory will stay open.
100%? You guarantee something 100%? I like those odds. So we're going to hold him accountable to his campaign promises.
Plus, a plan to combat tax evasion in India has unintended consequences.
There are thousands of weddings, thousands and thousands that have been put on hold because people can't pay in cash to the wedding vendors.
That and more today, right here on The World. Thank you for being with us. A lot to get to on the show today, including regulating hate speech in this country. Has it ever been done? And what'll happen now with all the nastiness currently in the air? One of many questions raised by the Donald Trump campaign and the transition. We're going to start off today looking at another aspect of that transition to the White House, conflict of interest. President-elect Trump's business empire is immense. He's got investments in at least 18 countries, and that includes golf courses in Scotland and Ireland and major buildings in Turkey, Qatar, Indonesia, and India. John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker. He's been looking at Trump's possible conflicts of interest and says the president-elect might already be skating on thin ice.
During the transition, there have been two or three very, you know, disturbing signs. The meetings with the Indian businessmen, the alleged phone call with the president of Argentina, where it was initially reported that Trump asked him to nod through the construction of a Trump Tower in Buenos Aires. That was subsequently denied. Mm. And now today we've got a third thing. It looks like Trump, when he was talking to Nigel Farage, the head of the UK Independence Party in the UK, asked him to oppose offshore windmills. Trump's got a big golf course in Scotland, which would have some unsightly windmills just offshore, and he's been opposing that. The British courts basically turned down his application to get that stopped, and now he seems to be trying to use his influence with Farage to further his business interests. That story has been confirmed. It hasn't been denied. So if he carries on like that when he's president, it's certainly going to become a huge issue, I think.
One thing we've been hearing from people who voted for Trump in various parts of the country is Trump is a businessman. It's good for America that he's been so successful in so many places. He'll bring that success to government. What do you make of that?
You hear that a lot. I heard that when I was out interviewing Trump voters. The question is, you know, now that he has been elected, should he be allowed to keep his businesses and operate them? The standard in the past has been for presidents to put up any assets they own in a blind trust, which is a trust run by an independent trustee, and the president doesn't know what this person is buying or selling in terms of investments.
John, can we just pause here for a moment so I can ask you what conflict of interest actually is and what the law says about conflict of interest for the president?
Well, that's what's sort of complicated here and may play to Trump's advantage. For most people who take a job in the federal government, conflicts of interest, very straightforward. If you have a business interest, which you might come into conflict with some of the decisions you're making or the role you're playing in the federal government, you have to break with that. For example, Hank Paulson, who was Treasury Secretary in the last Bush administration, sold his stock in. He was former CEO of Goldman Sachs. Before he became Treasury Secretary, he sold all his stock in the company and put it into a trust. That's what usually happens. Turns out, however, that for historical reasons, these rules or laws don't apply to the president and vice president. And that dates back to the very early days of the American Republic, when a lot of the presidents were very wealthy landowners and slave owners. There are still some other clauses which do apply to them, the so-called emoluments clause of the Constitution, which says that no president or vice president can take what amount to gifts from foreign governments that the country's doing business with. But the straightforward conflict of interest laws don't appear to apply.
If there are gross violations of standards and practices with the Trump presidency and his holdings and investments around the world, is there any legal recourse?
That's a very good question. I mean, that's what looks like, unfortunately, that's what we're going to find out. I mean, usually one would expect Congress to step in, but this, of course, is going to be a Republican-controlled Congress in both houses. I think it very much depends on what framework Trump actually sets up.
Do you think we're going to find out before he's taken oath of office what he's actually going to do with all these businesses?
The Trump Organization and his lawyers put out a statement last week that they're currently vetting various arrangements and will get back to us with what they decide to do. I would imagine there's, you know, big internal debates inside the organization. I'm sure some of his political advisors must be saying, look, Donald, you know, for appearances' sake, we need to go as far as we can towards, you know, separating you from these businesses. He hasn't said exactly what he wants, but I would imagine he'd like to keep as much control of them as he can.
What do you think is the way forward if Trump turns out to be more businessman than politician?
We're really in uncharted territory here. As you said at the beginning, Trump, one of the reasons some people voted for Trump is because they think we need a businessman in the White House. So I would imagine there'll be, you know, quite a lot of support from Trump's core supporters for him, if not running the business himself, just handing them over to his kids and, you know, keeping a close watching brief on them. But there'll also be, I think, quite a lot of outcry from the good government groups and moderates in Washington. If you've got the president dealing with foreign countries where he's got large-scale business interests, it does start to look a bit banana republicish.
John Cassidy with The New Yorker magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's one group in the U.S. that definitely wants Donald Trump to drum up as much business as possible, blue-collar workers in the Midwest. Many of them crossed party lines and helped hand Trump the presidency. Trump appealed to those workers with his tough talk against trade deals and globalization. It was a strong populist message that resonated in states like Indiana. But now those voters say Trump has to deliver. From Indianapolis, The World's Jason Margolis has that story.
If you close your eyes and imagine the stereotypical guy in the Rust Belt who got Donald Trump elected, a guy like Mike Fugate might come to mind.
I've been a registered Democrat my whole life, always voted Democratic, not this time.
I met Fugate at Sully's, an Indianapolis bar just across the way from the Carrier factory where they've been building heating and cooling systems since the 1950s. Fugate has worked there 25 years. But last February, the company said it was laying off 1,400 workers and shifting production down to Monterrey, Mexico. Carrier's parent company, United Technologies, reported $4 billion in profits last year.
They're shafting us. I think they don't have any concerns. You know, it's all about shareholders, profit, and going to Mexico, $20 an hour to $3 an hour. That says it all right there.
United Technologies wouldn't give me an interview, but they sent me an email highlighting the severance package being offered to workers, things like extended health care and education benefits. People here say thanks, but I want my job. Many workers put their faith in Trump because he said he'd keep their jobs here. Trump has said he'd slap a 35% tax on Carrier products coming back from Mexico. When Trump came to Indiana last spring, he gave a 100% guarantee that the Carrier factory would stay open under a Trump presidency.
100%. When you guarantee something 100%, I like those odds. So we're going to hold him accountable to his campaign promises.
That's Chuck Jones, president of the United Steelworkers Local 1999. Jones didn't vote for Trump, and the Steelworkers Union endorsed Hillary Clinton. Still, Jones says a lot of his guys got swept up by Trump's anti-trade messages.
You know, if it wasn't Trump, if Captain Kangaroo would have ran, he might have had a chance of winning because people were so fed up with the establishment politics, they were looking for something different, and it happened to be Trump.
But Jones thinks Trump was just making campaign promises that he can't keep.
You know, time will tell. You know, he's going to be the president whether we like it or not, and I hope he is successful or be devastating on this country.
In order for Trump to slap a tariff on heating and cooling products made in Mexico, first he'd have to withdraw from NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement signed in 1994. A president could technically do that without congressional approval. But many economists, like Mike Hicks at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, say scrapping NAFTA could have a devastating impact.
That's not going to save jobs. The problem is that, particularly in the Midwest, we're huge exporters. We're net exporters. And so you put a tariff in place, assuming that any other country decides to place a similar tariff on us, then the net effect is going to be a huge recession here in the Midwest.
Trump could also renegotiate NAFTA, but he would need to persuade Congress, as well as Canada and Mexico, to go along with any changes. And remember, congressional Republicans largely support free trade agreements. Hicks says that when politicians talk about getting tough on trade today, it's often just a soundbite. It resonates, though. 5.5 million American manufacturing jobs vanished between the years 2000 and 2010. But Hicks says only about 12% of those can be blamed on foreign trade. The rest disappeared because robots and computers have made manufacturing vastly more efficient. Consider an American car built in the 1970s.
What it took 1,000 workers to manufacture then, we can now do with about 250 men and women.
New jobs and new industries have been created, thanks in part to increased trade. But those jobs often don't pay as much. Back at Sully's Bar and Grill, Trump supporter Paul Roll could soon be out of a job with Carrier. He's worked there for 17 years.
I have 5 kids.
So what are you going to do?
I've been looking around, and most of the other places around here pay $13 to $15 an hour. So, I mean, I could always get 2 jobs to make the same income I already make.
And you make how much?
$23.83 an hour.
I asked Roll, who typically votes Republican, what was the top thing on your mind when you voted for Trump?
Top thing on my mind was Carrier, my job. I wanted to make sure I was going to be able to still support my family. I feel like he's the only candidate that really put our name out there during the debates. And he's given us hope that he's going to save our jobs.
Do you think he's going to save your jobs?
I believe he has the potential to, as long as he can get Congress to work with him on it.
Mike Fugate is less optimistic. He thinks Carrier is as good as gone for Mexico.
Yeah, I think it's a done deal.
If you think it's a done deal, then does that imply you don't believe Trump saying you're going to get your jobs back?
All we can do is hope.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Indianapolis.
President-elect Trump says he really wants to change things when it comes to U.S. foreign policy, but British foreign policy as well. Yeah, apparently Trump has some ideas about how our friends on the other side of the pond should do that too. And yesterday he shared them, not in a face-to-face meeting with the prime minister or in a confidential memo to the British embassy, but on Twitter, of course. The president-elect said that the British should choose a new ambassador to the United States, and he's got just the guy for the job, Nigel Farage. He would do a great job, Trump tweeted. You remember Farage, the leader of Britain's UKIP party, the driving force behind Brexit? Today, Farage seemed shocked by Trump's vote of confidence.
It was a bolt out of the blue. I wasn't expecting it for a moment. It shows he's got some confidence in me. He's a businessman. He's not a politician. He's a businessman. And in the world of business, you operate on trust. If you like people and you trust people, you want to work with them. And I think that's what his tweet reflects.
Of course, the British government has one small problem with Trump's plan.
We have a first-rate ambassador in Washington doing a very good job, and there is no vacancy for that position.
That's British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson in Parliament today responding to Trump's tweet. Johnson was referring to Britain's current ambassador to the U.S. His name is Sir Kim Darroch, one of the country's most senior diplomats. There's one other minor problem with Trump's request. Ambassadors are not selected by the countries they'll be emissaries to. They're selected by the countries they're representing. Here's Christopher Meyer making the point. He was the British ambassador to the U.S. during the George W. Bush years.
You cannot breach a principle which says the receiving power decides who's going to be appointed as ambassador for your country. And I think it's completely unprecedented, certainly in public, for a president-elect to suggest who he would like to see as British ambassador in Washington.
Well, even if Nigel Farage doesn't become ambassador to the U.S., he might get comped a room at the new Trump Hotel just down the street from the White House. You're with The World. What if the U.S. government suddenly decided to take all $10 and $20 bills out of circulation? You'd get the chance to trade them in for smaller denominations, but there'd be a limit on how much you could get at one time. Sounds like a giant pain at the very least, right? Well, that's essentially what the Indian government has done in an effort to deal with mass tax evasion. It's banned the most widely circulated bills, 500 and 1,000 rupee notes worth about $7.50 and $15 respectively. And it's a huge deal because India is, in many ways, still a cash economy.
A lot of people accept their incomes in cash. The formal pay stubs will give a certain percentage of their income, and then they'll take the rest in cash so that they don't have to claim it for taxes.
Siri Bulusu is a special correspondent for Bloomberg BNA based in Delhi. She says the poor, especially poor women, rely heavily on cash, and they don't have bank accounts.
A lot of people are struggling because so many people accept their income in cash. Now the stacks that they've been accumulating in their homes are literally worthless. It's no longer legal tender. Banks are exchanging old notes for new notes, but there are limits on that. They're only exchanging 2,000 rupees at a time, just under $30. So it's not really enough to get by day to day.
Right. And this whole thing has been especially hard on women, I gather. Explain that.
In India, banks haven't really made an effort or any sort of push to incorporate women into the formal financial system. Even when you have upper middle class educated women, husbands will sort of say, I'll be the one that has my own bank account. And when you need money to run the household, I'll give you cash. And so whatever small amounts they've sort of been putting aside for themselves, all of that money is useless. And for daily wage earners like cooks and maids, they won't have access to any sort of bank account.
So women often just keep their money at home? I mean, they put it under a mattress or something?
Literally, yeah. Yeah, they'll stuff pillows and mattresses. You know, most of the houses here will have closets with locks on them because it's just a given that people are going to be stashing jewelry and money at home.
So are the women that you know of at least trying to get on lines to the bank and trade in their money to get different notes?
Yeah. When I went around to speak to some of these women standing in line, some of them had come from the suburbs of New Delhi. So they'd spent an entire day traveling just to get in line. And it turned out that the banks had run out of the new currency notes.
So what happens to these women? They can't just come back the next day. That's many hours commuting.
Yeah, exactly. So when I went around to speak to some of the people waiting, I ran across a small group who was handing out water to people. There have been some reports of faintings and even some deaths due to dehydration from the heat standing in the queue. So we spoke with one woman who was handing out water.
People are standing in the line. They're just lower middle class people standing in line. For them, it's all their earnings, their savings. And they've been standing in lines for so long. So it does kind of give them a desperation and frustration, because after standing for 4 to 5 hours in the lines, they're not able to, you know, get money sometimes. The bank is out of money. The people who do not have bank accounts, you cannot even imagine how much worse it is for them, because it's like their entire life earnings.
I mean, that's what I was wondering, Siri. I mean, we're talking access to life savings. I mean, isn't the government in India aware of this, and are they relenting in any way?
The government is aware. Opposition is putting a lot of pressure on the government to create some sort of provisions for people to make sure they can have access to cash. Just recently, they sort of opened up the amount of money that can be withdrawn to about $2,200 so that people can pay for weddings. November and December, it's considered the most auspicious time of the year for weddings. And there are thousands of weddings, thousands and thousands that have been put on hold because people can't pay in cash to the wedding vendors.
Yeah, I mean, a wedding alone seems like, you know, you mess with an Indian wedding, people would get pretty angry. How furious are people with the government?
They're pretty mad. There's a lot of disappointment that there wasn't more time to prepare. And there are two schools of thought with this. On one side, people are saying if people had time to prepare, they would have drained all the black money, they would have hidden it or done something with it to then make the entire demonetization useless. And on the other side, they say, you know, the government's trying to crack down on tax evaders, but these people at the bottom of the pyramid here, these are not the people that the government was really directing this toward, and yet they're the ones who are suffering the most.
Siri, just clarify one thing for me. The woman we heard online a moment ago, she said it's much, much worse for people who don't have bank accounts. But if you don't have a bank account, you've got your money. You just have to get on a line and trade those bills in, right?
For those people without the accounts, even if they could exchange their money, it would take so long for it to happen that they would miss the deadline. And after New Year's, we really have no idea what's going to happen to all of those leftover bills.
Siri Bulusu with Bloomberg BNA in New Delhi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
El Perro del Mar, or the Dog of the Sea. Not exactly the stage name you'd expect for a Swedish musician, but don't tell that to Sarah Ospring. She says the name El Perro del Mar came from a trip to a Spanish beach and her connection with a stray dog there. These days, Ospring's making music from her home in Stockholm, Sweden. She recently told us what inspired her latest release.
My new album is called Kokoro, and this song is the first single from the album called Bread and Butter. Bread and Butter was one of the absolute first songs that were written for this album, and it came about exploring different instruments. I went to a music museum with my two-year-old son at that time, and I found some instruments that I just completely fell in love with, such as the gusheng, the Chinese gusheng. It's a kind of string instrument. If I could take you to the recording studio here in Stockholm where we recorded Kokoro, it would definitely be the picture of just an amazing room with shakuhachi flutes from Japan, different flutes from Africa, dulcimers of various sorts, different kinds of gushengs, organs, just a lot of wonderful instruments that I just completely, completely love. What I feel like, what I wanted to create with this album, a kind of borderless feeling that music from all places belongs together, and that's how music always functioned and should function. I want to kind of obliterate geographical borders between music and people. Listen, you got wrong, but it's not
your fault. El Perro del Mar from Stockholm, Sweden, there telling us about the inspirations behind her new album, Kokoro. Here's some more of her tune, Ding Sum. You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. When ISIS fled parts of northern Iraq 3 months ago, they lit massive fires, and they're still burning.
I can't begin to describe how surreal the scene is there. We saw many children running around with this kind of black soot over their face, and
almost every sheep in town is now turned black.
Plus, remembering Soul Wonder Woman Sharon Jones. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The battle to get the Iraqi city of Mosul out of ISIS control is still grinding on, and it's not just soldiers who are busy. Firefighters are working around the clock to put out fires from more than a dozen oil wells. Those blazes were set by ISIS militants. Massive clouds of black smoke have coated everything in and around the town of Garaya in black soot. The smoke is so dense that NASA satellites have been able to capture images of it from space. The World's Richard Hall is in northern Iraq covering the story. Richard, how and why did ISIS set these oil fires?
So ISIS set these oil wells on fire basically to protect themselves as they were retreating from the town. So what happened back in June is that the Iraqi army was advancing on the town. This was part of the offensive to recapture Mosul and the surrounding areas. And to protect themselves from airstrikes as they were retreating, they set these wells on fire. It kind of covered the sky with this black smoke, so U.S. coalition jets couldn't see them and couldn't target them as easy.
Right. And how well has that strategy worked for ISIS? Have they been able to avoid being targeted because of the smoke?
To some extent, yeah. It might have helped them in the retreat, but they're still being targeted pretty much every day by U.S. coalition jets. Another reason as well is that they wanted to kind of make things as difficult as possible for the government that was returning to Gayara by destroying the infrastructure in the town.
Well, now these fires have been going on for nearly 3 months, and only a handful, I gather, of these oil wells have been extinguished. What makes it so difficult to put them out?
Yeah, so we went there yesterday, and I can't begin to describe how surreal the scene is there. You can see the huge black clouds from miles and miles away, and you get into the town, and We saw many children running around with this kind of black soot over their face, and almost every sheep in town has now been turned black. And we spoke to a firefighter at one of the oil fires there, and he basically told us it's a really complex procedure how to put these fires out. One of the first things they have to do before they even start tackling the blaze is to check for mines and check for explosives that might have been left around these oil wells. There have been a number of cases just since I've been here of children, in fact, coming across stray mines that have been left by ISIS and being killed and injured by them. Then they need to kind of set up pipelines, water pipelines, to pump huge amounts of water into the wells. Then they need to cover it with dirt. They have experts from around the world helping them put these fires out, but the firefighter I spoke to just kind of, he emphasized that this was above his station almost.
How about the residents of this town? How are they dealing with it? I mean, because this has got to be nasty stuff.
Yeah, so we spoke to a couple of people. These fires have been burning for months now, and this horrible smoke is being inhaled by people. So we went to a clinic in Guyana and spoke to a doctor who told us about some of the effects this was having on the residents there.
طبعا اكثر الاعراض هي تنفسيه التهاب قصبات التهاب صدر.
So this doctor is telling me that most of the problems they're seeing in the clinic are related to breathing. They are seeing inflammation of the lungs, shortening of breath, and in some cases, some mild cases of suffocation. He's also saying that they get a lot of cases of diarrhea and vomiting due to the smoke. So there's just a huge amount of health problems. And the doctor also told us that this was affecting the elderly and children, young children under 10 years old most. I also met a couple of dozen kids playing soccer underneath this huge plume of black smoke, and I went to ask him how he could possibly play when all these fumes are cascading around him, and this is what he said to me. He's saying that we are Iraqis, we have lived many wars, we can do anything. And he also added, we are made of iron.
Yeah, I mean, that's very confident and all, but I mean, we're talking toxic smoke. I mean, they don't have masks, do they? I mean, this is going to be going on for at least a few more weeks, I'd expect.
Yes, as we drove around the town, we noticed that people weren't really wearing protective masks. You'll see some of the firefighters wearing these very basic surgical masks, but most people are just kind of walking around and they're inhaling smoke for most of the day.
So on top of a geopolitical crisis in northern Iraq, how much does this represent a new environmental crisis?
This is one of the things that the UN has warned about. They're actually looking at what happened in Kuwait to figure out what could happen here in Iraq. In the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein, some people remember, set alight to the oil fields in Kuwait while he was retreating for similar reasons. And what happened there was some damage to vegetation, and chemicals seeped their way into the groundwater and into the water supply. So what they're doing at the moment is getting ready to send teams out to really monitor the water supply here and monitor the soil and check for these kind of effects that might come about.
The World's Richard Hall in northern Iraq in Erbil. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Back to the post-election now. Most days it seems to me like half the country is celebrating a Trump victory, the other half is not. And it's leaving parents across the country wondering how to talk to their kids about what's going on. We want to take you now to Windsor, California. That's about an hour and a half north of San Francisco. There's a school in Windsor where most of the students are Latino. Classes are in both English and Spanish. And even before the election, the school had been tagged with graffiti that said, "Build the wall higher." Zadie Stavely has our story.
Good morning, boys and girls.
Good morning, maestra Villalpando.
The third graders at Cali Calmecac Language Academy are presenting book reports in their English class.
Hey, did you guys all share?
Yeah.
You did?
Okay.
In the middle of class, one little boy starts crying. Teacher Rosa Villalpando checks in with him. He says that after the election, he's afraid he'll have to move to Mexico. And some kids on his street won't play with him anymore.
They won't let me because they're like, no, you're a different color from us. It's a Trump president, we can't play with you.
Just know that I'm here and you could talk to me, okay? Let's breathe together, okay? You ready? Go into your nose, okay? Go.
Teachers here say that since the elections, even since the primaries, kids have been anxious, crying, complaining of stomach aches. Even kids whose parents are U.S. citizens. They worry their friends could be separated under Donald Trump's immigration policies.
The night of the election, that was the hardest part, was to know that I'd have to come and face the children on their worst nightmare. I mean, the way that they'd been presenting their anxiety and their fear.
Teachers in many parts of the U.S. are grappling with this. How to create a safe space for students while also respecting all political views. Most people in this part of California voted for Hillary Clinton, but about one-fifth supported Trump.
We're going to take out our writing. We'll go around, and if anyone wants to share theirs, they may. Okay? But you'll share.
Villalpando asks her students to read what they wrote in their journals the day after the election. A few students wrote that their parents voted for Trump or that Clinton was a mean person. But most wrote that they were scared or mad about the new president-elect.
Donald Trump may take my family away.
My grandpa is Mexican.
A lot of my friends are Mexicans.
He hates Mexicans.
I feel ashamed that America voted for Donald Trump.
That last kid is Cruz. He's 8.
I feel like a lot of people are prejudiced because they voted for him. And Donald Trump is prejudiced. And I don't think it was really fair that he got to win.
Cruz can't stop shaking. Villalpando asks a classmate to come breathe with him.
Do you want to come breathe with him?
Yeah. Okay, remember, we breathe together and it helps.
I can relate to the children's fears. And I think maybe that's why I'm sensitive to what they're feeling.
Villalpando points to a photo she has in her classroom of her and her siblings with their mom.
I lived with fear. I lived with fear because we were undocumented. And I did not become undocumented until I was 14. We had a fear of la migra. But now this fear seems different to me, feels so much more personal.
It feels more personal in part because a couple of weeks before the election, the school was tagged with graffiti that said "Build the Wall Higher" and "Trump 2016. Some kids were so upset they didn't want to come to school the next day. But the graffiti also triggered a response. 2 days later, community members welcomed students to the school with posters that said things like, "There are no walls in Windsor." Teacher Villalpando also created her own lesson plan in response.
So I took that upon myself to just ask them, what kind of things do we do for others? And they came up with lists: open the door for others, write thank you cards, pick flowers for someone we love.
Villalpando is also teaching the kids how Congress works and how it can check the president's power. She says it's hard.
But it's such a great time to be a teacher. It is our place to show them love and show them acceptance, of course, every day. But right now, when they need it the most, that's security. Some people may think it's maybe doing too much, but I think it's just important. We can't pretend it's not happening.
Mom Patricia Figueroa says she thinks it's working.
Ha disminuido mucho el estrés en los niños.
She says that the children's stress has gone down a lot. Even so, she says, her daughter still asks her, "Mommy, are you going to have to go to Mexico?" For The World, Zadie Stavely, Windsor, California.
Well, as you heard, Donald Trump's victory has left some people feeling that the lid on hate speech has been ripped off. The Southern Poverty Law Center has reported some 700 incidents of harassment and abuse since Election Day. But here's the thing. Hateful speech is not a crime. The First Amendment to the Constitution specifically says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. So how did that come about? Nadine Strossen is a professor at the New York Law School and a former president of the American Civil Liberties Union. I asked her what prompted the founders to enshrine this concept in the Constitution in the first place.
It was really an essential element of separating both from Great Britain and from the legal system of Great Britain that we moved from parliamentary sovereignty to popular sovereignty, government by we the people, as the opening words in the Constitution say. And for we the people to be the governors, we have to have the right to criticize those we elect to represent us, even in very caustic, vitriolic terms. The founders themselves engaged in extremely vigorous expression that was as abusive and abrasive as what we call hate speech today, with respect to each other and in particular with respect to government officials.
Were there words that prompted violence?
That's a really good question, Marco, because I have to say the fact that words are conveying a hateful idea is not enough alone for them to be punished under our system. But if in a particular context the hateful words cause a particular harm that is demonstrably connected to the speech, they can be punished. So when you say, did the words cause violence or lead to violence, the Supreme Court has said that if a speaker intentionally incites imminent violence that is likely to happen imminently, then that speech may be suppressed. And much hate speech does satisfy that definition.
As for hate speech, strictly hate speech, have there ever been attempts by the executive at state or federal level to regulate it?
There have been. In fact, there was one case that went to the Supreme Court in 1992 of a city, St. Paul, Minnesota, that passed an ordinance outlawing any expression that aroused to anger, alarm, or resentment on the basis of race, religion, national origin, and a few other criteria. And the Supreme Court unanimously held that it was unconstitutional.
There are colleges all over the country, though, that now regulate what people can say and can't say on campus. I mean, I guess I get the impulse not to have the quad the site of a Klan or an ISIS rally, but how can colleges do that and not get taken to court?
They are taken to court. Not every single college in every single instance that it enforces these codes. We've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of colleges, but the American Civil Liberties Union has brought a number of lawsuits challenging so-called hate speech codes on campus. We've won every single one. Believe me, I don't mean to trivialize. Words are very powerful. They can cause a lot of pain as well as a lot of joy, and that is precisely the reason why we protect them, because we recognize that an even greater harm than being hurt in your pride or angered or, you know, insulted, which words certainly can very powerfully do, but even worse than that is handing over to government a necessarily discretionary, subjective tool just to decide which words to punish. That is not a power that we, the people, should trust the government to exercise.
Hypothetically, Nadine, if somebody, a member of the executive, says something you think is hateful, can you bring a lawsuit against them?
No. You do not forfeit your First Amendment rights by virtue of being a government official. Now, this is a really interesting question, Marco, because if somebody does something discriminatory in an official capacity, let's say flies the Confederate flag from a state capitol building, to cite a certain example, there I think there could be an argument that for government to officially endorse a discriminatory symbol is for government to violate its requirement to uphold equal protection of the laws. But a government official speaking in a personal capacity is completely free to express his or her views and then is subject to political retribution, but not legal retribution. You know, you can vote against that person, you can try to impeach that person, but you can't and should not be able to censor that person. Believe me, if I have an official who has certain ideas, I'd rather know about them. I'd rather have them be out in the open where I could take constructive action.
Nadine Strossen, professor at the New York Law School and former president of the ACLU. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Marco. Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. One of my favorite musicians ever, Sharon Jones, died this past weekend. She was an old school soul and funk singer par excellence. Her band, the Dap Kings, fueled her high energy shows.
100 days!
If you'd gone to those shows in recent years and seen her, it was not apparent that Sharon Jones had been fighting cancer unless she talked about it from the stage, which she often did. Matt Rogers is a documentary filmmaker who had been following Sharon Jones' career from her lean days to her storybook success. He joins me now from Los Angeles. Now, the first time you saw Sharon Jones was in New York about 15 years ago. I know you were smitten immediately and then followed Sharon on some dates to Canada. Just talk about the reception Sharon Jones got in New York compared with what you saw in Canada.
Well, what was most stunning was in New York, when I saw her, it was actually for a CMJ showcase. Those are for bands, you know, trying to make an impression on the music industry. It was in downtown New York, and maybe there were 20 people there. You know, Sharon gave an amazing show, a very electric show, and I just couldn't believe that there were so few people in this, you know, quote-unquote hip New York City club. Then shortly thereafter, I followed the band up to Montreal and to Toronto, and in the Montreal gig, there were probably about 600 people crammed into this sold-out club and absolutely went bananas for Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. You know, where was this love down in New York as opposed to over the border?
And it wasn't just in Canada. I mean, she got major love from a lot of places overseas at first, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, this was the case in Canada. This was the case particularly in the UK and then eventually Australia.
Well, there's this moment in a radio documentary you produced for Australian Broadcasting in which Sharon spoke about that kind of soul music disconnect, the trouble of filling a club in New York when she was first coming up compared with Europe.
When we perform in certain places here, it's just like, sometimes I feel a little sad sometimes because I was like, wow, you know, you go to these clubs, people come, and I know there's a lot of people that love the funk, but it's just like, hey, I come here and play at a club here and you got the people there and you go in Europe and that same club, they have to turn people away from the door.
Matt Rogers, just remind us briefly of her success story, because even at the age of 50, not even a decade ago, Sharon Jones wasn't exactly what you would call a star. I mean, she worked really hard, didn't she?
She absolutely did. I mean, in for many years when she was in the Dap Kings and touring and recording albums at Daptone in Brooklyn, she still worked in a wedding band that she'd worked in for many years because it paid her, frankly, it paid her more than she was earning. And finally, she really broke through, it seems, around in the States and around when she turned 50 in 2006. And I think her biggest show was in New York. They had a 50th birthday party at Irving Plaza in downtown New York, and it was sold out. And it really felt like sort of a takeoff point. And she started, you know, appearing on television and whatnot in the States. And it really seemed like she was on the upward trajectory in the States. Not necessarily on the same degree as abroad, but that people were really starting to take notice of her here.
I mean, this was the experience for a lot of African-American jazz musicians, but I'm just curious how much you think Sharon Jones's success overseas became the calling card, the referral letter, if you will, for the sold-out shows that she would eventually put on here in the States.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that really was the case to a large degree with Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And, you know, that also, it didn't hurt that, I mean, and then literally what really put them over the top or helped put them over the top was they had an English talent come on over to the U.S. and that really helped them boost over. And the English talent was Amy Winehouse.
You also witnessed a very kind of empathetic and poignant side to Sharon Jones on another occasion with Amy Winehouse. I'd like you to tell us about that.
I did. So in 2008, Sharon and the Dap Kings, they were performing. They were doing a UK tour, and they were performing at the Jazz Cafe. And this was, Amy was definitely at her height in popularity, but it was also when she was at a height with the tabloids, and she was definitely on a downward spiral. And one night on a string of these shows, Amy showed up backstage to watch the show, and you know, it was clear she was in a world of hurt, basically. You know, after the show, Sharon, you know, saw that Amy was there, and she gave her a hug, and she basically took Amy into the bathroom. She took her away from everyone, and she wanted to literally sit down and have a talk with Amy Winehouse. And she was probably in there for, I don't know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes.
Do you know what they talked about?
What Sharon told me that night was that she basically just held Amy. She held her, consoled her, and told her that, you know, she needed to stop all of this addiction business, and she needed to get back to her music, to recording, and to being with her fans, because that's who she was and what she needed to be about. It was very touching to me because, you know, Sharon, she was helped with the Dap Kings working with Amy Winehouse. That certainly helped Sharon's career because it gave the music press a hook to link the Dap Kings with Amy and Sharon, and it certainly helped Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album sales, and it helped them with gigs, etc. But, you know, Sharon didn't necessarily have to be so empathetic and sympathetic to Amy that night, and she really was. She really took this maternal approach as a sympathetic peer. I was struck by that.
So any of us who'd seen Sharon Jones in recent years, we know she owned her cancer, but always stayed positive about it. She'd say from the stage, "I have cancer, but it doesn't have me." What kept Sharon Jones positive? Like, what is the Sharon Jones molecule we should all have within us?
Really, that molecule is never give up. I mean, she never, ever gave up. She didn't know how to. And no matter how debilitated she felt or sick she felt, she went after it. You know, and coupled knowing, you know, her context of her being rejected so many times in her life from trying to be a lead singer in this popular music world, she kept at it. Her attitude really was, "I'm never going to give up."
Well, Sharon Jones was inspirational that way. How about we go out today, Matt, with a great tune called Inspiration Information. I know, you know, she used to cover it occasionally in concert.
That's a great, great Shuggie Otis tune. That's a great way to go out.
Matt Rogers, remembering with us the late Sharon LaFay Jones. Thank you very much, Matt.
Thank you, Marco.
Information from Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. And that's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.